This month's podcast features Michael B. Horn, an author, speaker, and consultant who is known for his work in education innovation and blended learning. As written by ChatGPT, he is the co-founder of the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation, a nonprofit think tank that focuses on using innovation to improve education and other industries. In addition to his writing, Horn is a frequent speaker on education innovation and has given talks at conferences and events around the world. He has also worked as a consultant for schools, districts, and education organizations, helping them to design and implement new teaching models and technologies. We would like to thank ChatGPT for providing the biographical information for this introduction. In this podcast, you'll hear Michael's take on artificial intelligence and ChatGPT after extensive research using writing prompts.
As amazing as it is, and it is incredible. I mean, if you play with this thing, it's amazing. It's not like it's just writing, you know, the perfect essay is the first statement, even as it's writing a very good one.
And how artificial intelligence in the classroom may eventually help not only teachers to connect with students, but also with families.
All of a sudden, we've created a much more personal set of conversations that have occurred in the classrooms and connections between educator and students. And frankly, then it's not that much harder to imagine how that extends to the families themselves. As part of that.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning, resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized self-paced curriculum helps raise individual and school performance by maintaining grade-level skills and targeting unfinished learning. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. Michael Horn has co-authored several books on education innovation, including Disrupting Class, How Disruptive Innovation Will Change the Way the World Learns, and Blended, Using Disruptive Innovation to Improve Schools. These books explore how new technologies and teaching models can be used to improve student learning outcomes. In a recent conversation with JFY Network's Executive Director Gary Kaplan, they discussed how ChatGPT and artificial intelligence will impact not only our schools, but also our society.
Okay, Michael, nice to see you. How are
Likewise.
You doing? Michael, you know, I kind of want to start with ChatGPT. Did you happen to see the Wall Street Journal Saturday, the Henry Kissinger piece and Eric Schmidt?
I saw that they wrote something, but I have not read it, I confess.
The title is ChatGPT heralds an intellectual revolution. They conclude, we have a novel and spectacular achievement that stands as a glory to the human mind. We have not yet evolved a destination for it. As we become homo technicus, we hold an imperative to define the purpose of our species.
Oh, there you go. I guess they just redefined our species too. They said we're no longer Homo sapiens based on exogenous technology.
So what do you think about that? What does it mean?
Well, breathtaking.
Should we all go be looking for a job?
That's breathtaking. I mean, to me, what it suggests and what I'm seeing so far is actually much more what we've seen with other technologies, which is that it's the combination of the technology with the human that creates the real breakthrough. And in the same way that was true with artificial intelligence of chess playing computers that, yes, I guess could beat Garry Kasparov, perhaps not Garry Kaplan, but the couple amateur humans with the AI was even better than that. And so I think that's the principle that we keep coming back to, is one of complementarity. And at least from my reading, whether it's, you know, the hysteria around using it in education, whether it's the question of how does it redefine work, whether it's the question of, I guess, how does it change our thinking patterns? If I understand what Dr. Kissinger and Eric Schmidt are talking about, I think it's still the case that, at least in the moment, what we still have is a model that is probabilistic based. That means that, you know, if it sees Hobbes and Locke quoted in the same articles over and over again. It's not going to necessarily know which one said which, you know, concept, but it turns out that that's a pretty important distinction to understanding the two philosophers and also understanding competing philosophies. And so I see it as an incredible tool, an incredible productivity enhancer, but I don't know that it's, and it's a leapfrog for sure, but I don't know that it's redefines our relationship in some ways with the world, if that makes sense, to quite the extent that they seem to be arguing.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a you know, big question. Let's just kind of try to scale it down a little bit into just the world of education. let's not worry about the species right now. let's worry about the classroom. You know, in your podcast on January 17th, when you and Diane were talking about this, I think it was Diane, or maybe who said AI is forcing us to ask. She was talking about the essay as the basic basic tool of inquiry or teaching. So AI can write better essays than we can. AI is forcing us to ask, I mean, ChatGPT is forcing us to ask whether any of those things, meaning literary form, grammar, any of those elements of writing, whether any of those things are worth keeping around, whether any of those old conventions are worth keeping around, because AI can do all that. So why do we need to learn literary form? Why do we need to learn grammar? We can just plug in AI and out comes a grammatically perfect product.
Yeah, somewhat. So it's interesting. Since then, someone who's a student right now at the Harvard Kennedy School, Danny Curtis, and I have fed ChatGPT the Engage New York curriculum of essay prompts from 4th through 12th grade across 3 different genres of writing. So persuasive, expository, and narrative. And the piece will be coming out in Education Next at some point. But in essence, what we found is ChatGPT always gets above a passing grade. So then we had human graders grade the pieces on a rubric. It always gets a passing grade, but it steadily declines as you go older in the years. And the questions become both more complex, but also the topics get more, you know, dependent on a knowledge base and dependent on actually having closely read the texts on which it's drawing. And so a surface level scanning, in essence, or whatever you would call it, doesn't necessarily cut the bill. You can still get a D plus or a C minus, but
yeah,
this is not as amazing as it is. And it is incredible. I mean, if you play with this thing, it's amazing. It's not like it's just writing, you know, the perfect essay is the first statement, even as it's writing a very good one. And so one, you can say, well, it's clearly going to improve. And that's true, right? ChatGPT-4 will be out probably this summer. We'll see it continue to improve. They say that they're going to start to tackle the factual errors that it makes and so forth. We'll see. But I think what I take from it is that one, and what Diane took from it as well, is that we miss, when we talk about the artifacts that it produces, we miss, and I know you'll agree with this based on your background, we miss realizing that the reason we engage in the writing processes is so that we as individuals can master competencies, so that we can wrestle with critical thinking. And so the process actually of going through that has its own value for us as humans, and that these forms are still incredibly important forms for communicating and storytelling to each other as a human species, but frankly, even for the ChatGPTs of the world to digest the information that they're digesting. And then I would say that what that means, though, is that then ChatGPT becomes this incredible tool to up-level the products or capabilities that we as individuals ultimately have as we produce these things. So in other words, and the analogy has been made too many times around the calculator is to math as ChatGPT is to English. But I think where there's some truth in that, you know, tool perhaps understates what it is, but I think it is a tool, right? There's a series of prompts that you can ask it. It's sort of, first, it's your research assistant to help you, you know, figure out certain questions outside of the text that maybe you want to chase down. And then you've got to learn how to, you should ask it, what's the source material? And you should go into the source material and actually verify, did it get it right? You know, I was doing this recently with a piece I wrote about my trip to Africa, and I was trying to figure out the spend in US dollars that Sierra Leone does. And it came back with an answer, $96. And I said, okay, what's your source for that? And they said, these World Bank documents and so forth. So I went into them and I couldn't replicate it. I kept coming out with $69. And I said, this is what I'm coming up with. This is how I got there. And they said, I apologize. I think your figure is right. And so, but it was still useful because I couldn't figure out on my own how to wade through the World Bank documents. I knew
it gave you a source.
It gave me a source. It was helpful, right? And so, and then it helped me navigate the source as well, because even then I didn't know exactly, I couldn't figure out where they were pulling it from, which charts, you know, in the Bureau of Statistics, right, that you get in these databases. And so it helped me pull that out. And then I was able to triangulate that, right? And figure and do my own currency conversions and the like. Now, I think you could feed your own prose into it and say, what do you make of this? Summarize it back for me. Does it understand what I wrote? Does that mean I need to write something clearer? It can be a useful editor of sorts on top of you. In the same way, we're able to now use it for non-code programming. I think we can use it in a way as sort of an editor and research assistant on your writing to make sure your product is significantly better, but also in the process of doing that, that you get better in terms of what you, and I like that phrase, not just what you know, sort of not just the knowledge base that's produced, but your actual individual understanding. I think that's a nice way to think about it.
It's a good distinction. Human knowledge, human understanding. And their point is that this is fundamentally different from the Enlightenment, which was all about human understanding. This is kind of all taking place aside from any human participation. It's, you know, somehow we've started it going.
Outsourced things, yeah.
Yeah, we started it going, and now it's just, it's kind of, we pushed it downhill and it's just going downhill. And
well, it is interesting on that topic, right? Because I think we still want the humans to be able to understand how these new tools work and function. We want them to be able to get underneath it and both improve, leverage, right, et cetera, them, but know when to shut them off, know when to create more, et cetera. And it occurs to me, though, the second thing is at least this model is still a large data model, right? And so big data that contains errors does not make it good data. It can still be bad data. And so
sure.
I think we have to, you know, sort of reckon with that. Now, as I understand the technology, which is not nearly deep enough, but there are some AI models starting to be built out of small data sets. And so that suggests the possibility anyway that you could be more precise and structured, right, in the AI and more useful within a narrow band, I think would be the implication.
I think in the education field of reference, what's most just the fundamental question, and I think a kind of a fundamental misunderstanding is that what we're looking for in education is not a perfect essay or a test score. We're looking for the student to have developed, as you know, as these guys say, to have developed her understanding.
Yeah,
I mean, you made the point in the podcast, bring it back to learning, and not just the artifact.
Well, and I think that's right. It's in the same way as the same problem that we've had in medicine for decades. Right, is that the human body, as Clay Christensen used to like to say. is not super articulate. It only has a limited means to express underlying problems, disorders, diseases that occur. And it expresses this in what we call symptoms. And these symptoms are incredibly inarticulate about the actual root cause of the problem that they have. And that's kind of like grades and test scores and even papers, is they are artifacts or symptoms might not quite be the right word, but they're manifestations of what we're trying to do in humans. And they are useful, but they aren't the number by itself, or the thing by itself is not necessarily what we're after. It's evidence of what we're after.
So Diane said technology is a tool. We should use it to redesign models of schools and learning environments. What is, you know, where do we go with that? So we have this new tool, and yeah. It's got all kinds of potential, and we have this concern about plagiarism or cheating and so forth. But is this going to push us to redesign models of schools and learning environments, or the entire, you know, the entire learning process? What, you know, yeah. Is this really a whole transformation of what, of everything?
Well, so I like the way you asked it on the first go around, right? Which is, does it push us to do these things? And at the moment, the evidence is unclear, because Los Angeles, New York, Seattle, a bunch of places, their reaction was to ban ChatGPT.
Of course. I think,
you may want to talk about other bans later, but you know, this instinct to ban is, in this case in particular, is beyond laughable, because the students just go home and do it there. So I'm not sure what they're not sure what they're accomplishing. And so that's the reason, I think, to think that it might actually cause us to innovate the fundamental forms that we've had, because that's a losing battle. And my argument is, you know, I think this should feed the sort of reinvention that I've long argued for, which is to move toward an active learning, mastery-based learning environment in which students are doing work and you only indicate that they've moved on fully from a concept once they demonstrate mastery of it in some form. And I think that answers part of the thing, which is that so much of the focus has been on the cheating, and we've got to catch the students, and pitting educators against students yet again. And I think our system, our zero-sum time-based system, is what does that, because we obsess over the grades, the sorting, the this, the that, the artifacts, as opposed to a mastery-based positive sum model, which is the teacher saying, like, I'm in your corner, Gary, I want you to understand this concept. And if it takes you a couple reps, that's okay. We'll be patient with you, right? Like, it's not about the speed here. It's about enduring understanding, to use that word again. And that, I think, would take away some of the impetus to cheat, because the evidence would be you're cheating yourself, not like the system in some sense, right? And so that's one shift I think would help. The second one is that the learning environments themselves would be far more active. And that might mean that there's times where we say, okay, you've done all this work at home, you've done all this work the last few weeks, we're going to put our computers down, and Gary, you're going to give a 15-minute oral, you know, presentation on this, or Gary, you're going to debate Michael on this question of what did Virginia Woolf think when blah blah blah, you know. That's great. Now you're getting to think on your own, built on all this reservoir of support and work that you've had. And, you know, and then ChatGPT, and that becomes, again, a tool to doing, a tool to problem solving. And maybe, as Diane said in the podcast episode, you could use it to produce, you know, what would a good written or oral argument on X look like? And let's dissect that then to see where it has flaws and where it has good things, so that we can even further deepen our understanding of effective communication, but also of whatever the underlying knowledge or concept that we're trying to understand is.
The exemplar.
Yeah.
So what this, where this is going is, in order to, the teacher, it's a much more, personal kind of a face-to-face connection between the teacher and the student. If it's not about the student is sitting in class doing some kind of work on either on paper or on the computer, and the teacher is sitting up there at the desk, if the student has already done all that stuff, if it's a flipped classroom, and the student did all that stuff outside the classroom, and we're coming into the classroom to discuss, debate, whatever, that's an entirely different model of the classroom.
Yes.
How many classrooms do you walk by where you see that going on rather than a student sitting there in front of a computer?
Well, there's a handful, but the there's not nearly enough. I mean, I would say I don't see a heck of a lot with students sitting in front of the computer. I see a heck of a lot where students are still sitting in front of the teacher in rows, right? And so
yeah. But it's not interactive.
No. And that's what we're trying to change, is that sit and get passive environment into an active one. And look, there are hundreds and hundreds of great examples of schools doing it right, I would argue. But we, at this point, from a system perspective, no, obviously the standard is the passive sit and get approach.
Yeah, still. That's the old sage on the stage.
Yes.
Do you happen to know of any schools around here, around Boston, where anything like that is going on, where the classroom is a, you know, an actual symposium?
So I think there's actually lots of examples. I mean, you go to the Wildflower Montessori schools, right, at the early years, or you go to the Montessori schools in the middle schools, or you go to Acton Academy in Winchester, or places like that. I think that there are some really good examples.
Do you know of a public school?
I thought you were going to go there as your next question. And I was racking my brain on that one. I don't know off the top of my head. Yeah. You know, there were some ones in the middle of the state that were doing some things with Summit Learning that were pretty neat, but I don't know where they've gone, to be totally candid. And my impression and my visits suggest it's far more the exception than the norm, particularly in Massachusetts relative to the rest of the country, even.
Really?
Yeah, I think Massachusetts is way behind on this.
Really?
Yeah.
No kidding. What's your source for that?
Well, I get to go around the country.
Yeah,
I look
you travel.
Canopy.
Yeah,
there's the Canopy Project of innovative schools that transcend, and Center for Reinventing Public Education host. And so you can see things there. There's a lot of, and you know, I was on the board of the Silicon Schools Fund that was changing schools in California, and Transcend their work with a lot of schools. There's not a lot of activity in Massachusetts. And on the one hand, people would say, well, that, you know, Massachusetts has the best test scores, so why do we need it? And on the other hand, you'd say, well, Massachusetts has the third highest achievement gap in the country. So I suggest to me that it's not the schools that's creating these results, but a lot of the families and parents. And as you know, 13%, I think it is, of a student's waking hours are spent in school. So there's a heck of a lot of other influences that are contributing to that. But I see a lot of, you know, blended learning schools throughout the country that I think are doing some really good work around this. And again, I don't want to say it's the norm.
Well,
I don't think it is, but I think that there are some really great examples.
What's the closest one? You're in Connecticut, right?
No. I'm in Massachusetts.
Where are you?
I'm in Lexington. Yep.
Oh, you're in Lexington. Oh, I didn't know that. Yep. Okay. So what's the closest to here? I mean, I'm in Canton. What is the closest to here? Is there some place that we could go?
I think there's
visit?
Places in Rhode Island. I think there's places in New Hampshire. That are doing a good job of this. I think, you know, New Hampshire's the one that immediately comes to mind is a virtual school. So it's not a brick and mortar environment.
What's the name of the
Learning Academy Charter School, VLAX, I think is an incredible model. In Rhode Island, the Mayoral Prep Academies, I think, Public School Network are doing some cool work around this. Anyway, there are places that are doing neat work where I think they are challenging this sit and get model. And look, I think Vermont, you know, has pushed for personalized learning plans. So I suspect there's some public schools there that have maybe moved as well, although I can't name any off the top of my head.
If we no longer trust measurements like a paper or a test, because they're all now suddenly corrupted by this this new technology, and we have to somehow figure out how to get into the mind of the student and see what actually happened, if anything, how are we going to do that?
Yeah, well, so take the Virtual Learning Academy Charter School actually as an example in New Hampshire. Yeah. They have, and I'm going to mess this up because I don't have notes in front of me, but they let's call it four or five ways to assess mastery of a learning objective or competency. And so the student can say, ready to show mastery. And one of those ways is an oral assessment. So sits with the teacher. And honestly, I think within 5 minutes, most teachers know, does Michael get it or not? Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a powerful model. Now look at schoolhouse.world, which is Khan Academy. It's their tutoring site. And to assess whether Gary is able to, be a tutor in whatever subject, what they do is other people who have been verified as expert in that domain look at Gary's performance on some tasks, and you record yourself, video record yourself doing, a task and walk and talking your way through it as you do it. And then these people, objective people that don't know Gary, they look at you and say, yeah, he's mastered that. Or I don't really want him in front of kids talking about that because he has no idea, whatever it is, right? And so I think these third-party assessment of, again, it's still going to be of work, it's still going to be of artifact, but watching you do the work, I think, is going to be really powerful as a piece. And I know there's ways to game that as well, but I think the point being that the performance assessment and having a third-party person who's not your teacher watching you do that can quickly get a sense like, yeah, you actually understand this. And there's no emotional piece in me that's saying like, I love Gary, so I'm just going to say he did it. Or I despise Gary's presence in my classroom, so I'm going to say he can't. Instead, like, as the educator, I just get to be your advocate and I'm going to help you get there. It's like your piano teacher. They don't sit there at the competition judging you. Their sole job is to help prepare you to get up there and do a great job, but that's going to become the educator. And then you hope that there's these other folks. And I think there's ways to do that, whether distributed or in person, that help assess. Yeah. That's mastery of that objective task, whatever it might be.
It's like the PhD defense, the oral defense.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had this. We just sort of extended it.
On a very small scale.
Now, Western Governors University, higher education, right? Online competency-based university. They serve north of 160,000 students a year. And they have two kinds of assessments. So there's the objective, right or wrong, multiple choice. But then there's the performance-based assessment. Same thing. It's graded by a human being that does not know you. So they've figured out how to do this at some scale and have inter-rater reliability, you and I can together look at someone's performance. And if we interpret that differently against the rubric, then they can check that and so forth, but at some level, we're just trying to understand like, hey, are you able to do what you want doing? And in fact, I'm okay if you want to use ChatGPT as an input into that process. I suppose that's the other thing. We need to think about what are the tasks themselves that we want to see you ultimately be able to do right as well.
So posit the question: does it matter whether this essay or this report or whatever it is? Does it matter if the content of it is good? Does it matter whether I got it off of ChatGPT or it came out of my own head? Does it matter?
I mean, yeah, I think that it the question is the purpose of that, right? Is the purpose for, did I get the awesome marketing thing so that my company in the world of work can sell more product? Doesn't matter where it came from, right?
Right.
If the purpose is I want to understand, does Gary understand this so that he can do more complex work and be a more valuable person in society, at work, at whatever, then yes, it does matter, right? And so yeah. I think that's yeah. I think the question is one of purpose.
So, and if ChatGPT is based on prior stuff, everything that's in the can and on the shelf, where does innovation come out of that? If everything it does is based on past
you've
ideas,
just named it. Right? Right. You've just named it, which is that it can take ideas and associate them in novel ways to create, which one could argue that's what human beings do, but it's going, and it can do it in dozens and dozens and dozens of permutations. Finding out which of those is useful and where we really build something around it for innovation, I suspect is still going to be the job of humans, right? Does it help us make progress?
Yeah, that's really a good question. You know, where does innovation come from?
Yeah. It'll be a tool again in this, right? Like, I mean, you think about small bore innovation, right? And maybe this is the way to think about it, right? There's one kind of innovation of like, I'm trying to find a drug that matches this particular genetic phenotype of a disease or whatever. And so I just need to pattern match the heck out of all these compounds, and just the machine that can do the biggest grunt work and come up with the associations and give me the, you know, like that's the thing, right? And so AI is super useful. It's taking knowledge, it's associating it in novel combinations, and it's creating a compound on the other end that hopefully can solve something, right? Then there's the question of like, no, but I actually want a totally new paradigm of which to think of this problem. Like, I want to think about the problem through an entirely different lens. I suppose that would be like mRNA as opposed to a DNA based view of like, you know, the vaccine or something like that. And so my guess is that steps outside of the program's logic, and that's where human beings come in to look at things creatively and at disciplines that are not associated with the code, if you will. But I don't know. I think it's a good question. I mean, this gets to one of my friend Bob Mestas, his favorite questions, which are there really any new ideas at all in the world? And I sort of say, good question. It's a little reductivist, and I'm not sure it matters, right? There's probably fewer new ideas than we think, but I do think, you know, Leonardo da Vinci comes along, someone comes along and it makes a leap, and these things do change how we look at certain domains.
Well, take something closer to home, the whole idea of disruptive innovation.
Sure.
A machine could have thought of that?
No, because it has to ask the right question, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the role, and maybe that's the best way to say it, is humans are really going to be the question askers.
Yeah. What was the... it was the disk drive, right? The thing that
he
kept
exactly
on,
where, yep,
what,
exactly
he kept
where
it on the shelf behind him.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right. And
that little thing.
The question he had was, why do successful companies fail?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that's not a question others had thought of, nor would a computer necessarily think of.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Take something like cubism. Could a machine have developed that? That stylistic departure. Could a machine have thought, well, what if we looked at it from this angle and then that angle, and then we chopped it all up and stuck it all back together? Could a machine?
Well, I think that's, I think your point is the right one, right? Which is, a machine might have accidentally come up with something like that, but would it have redefined a genre? Probably not, because it wouldn't have asked the question from an orthogonal perspective, right? And I think that's the, in a deliberate way, that's what human beings, I think, can still uniquely do. They can still set out, get outside of rules-based thinking or even
patterns.
Probabilistic models, right?
Patterns, you know, patterns. Patterns are prisons. You know, we develop,
yes, that's
these
right,
patterns, and then we get,
well, like,
trapped in,
I mean, you know, a geocentric view of the universe, right, is the same thing, right?
Right?
If you built a computer that just crunched data based on that paradigm, it would show you all sorts of novel conclusions and formulas and so forth for calculating when, you know, Venus will come across the night sky and all sorts of things, right? But it would still be doing it from a flawed paradigm. You would imagine that it would be a human being that would say, well, what if?
What if? Okay, I want to make another leap, but before I make that leap, two quotations. These guys in the journal the other day, they refer to Kant Of course. I mean, I'm sure that's got to be Kissinger. Global harmonization will need to emerge either by perception or by catastrophe, as Immanuel Kant predicted 3 centuries ago. So I tried to look up what did Kant say about, I didn't go, you know, pull out all my my whole Kant collection. I tried to look it up in, you know, Google. What did Kant say about that? All I could find was, we can only have knowledge of things we can experience. So if you go back to the, you know, knowledge versus understanding, that little dichotomy, we can only have knowledge of things we can experience. The more that we outsource our experience to, you know, technological processes like AI, we're not having direct experience anymore. We're getting it mediated through, you know, a whole system. It's not our experience. It's a bunch of other people's experiences scraped up by the algorithm. Okay, that's one thing. So does that mean that human knowledge starts to either deteriorate or not develop any further because we're totally dependent on the delivery system that we created? But that system can only deliver what's on the shelf in the warehouse. And yeah. Where do we get new products on the shelves if our entire connection to the outside world is happening through some mechanism of mediation like that?
Yeah, I mean, it really, I think, is the last time I was on your podcast, we talked about the importance of knowledge, right? And that some people just want to sweep that under the rug and just focus on skills, but that these things are in fact coupled. they're not independent variables, if you will. And I think that's the same thing here, which is to say, we can have, you know, instead of the 26 encyclopedias or whatever it was we had 30 years ago, we can now have terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of quote unquote knowledge that exist and that are cataloged and that the AI quote unquote knows, but still to be able to ask productive questions, to be able to make these leaps, to figure out what is uniquely human, to figure out the ethical questions around some of these technologies and where we are and aren't going to use them and how we're going to use them and so forth requires human understanding. And so I think continuing to invest in the knowledge building and the skills, and look, this is one more part of it. And will it obviate certain things? Perhaps, but we don't yet know exactly what those are. But we do know that technology, I think, remains a wonderful tool, and it is a terrible master.
The ethical, you know, what these guys are saying is it goes beyond that. It's metaphysical.
Yeah, and so we'll see that. Yeah.
The other.
I would have understood that more if we were talking about the metaverse. I think I'm a little bit more surprised.
Well,
about the AI.
That's another whole thing. Let's not talk about that today. But okay. but it's actually the same thing. Because that's just another constructed.
It's an instantiation of
yeah,
digital bytes. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the underlying real dangerous thing about all of these things is that it's a cognitive universe that's constructed by somebody else, not by you.
Yeah.
So your experience is being constructed by, you know, people you don't even know, maybe the government, maybe the Chinese Communist Party, who knows, but you're no longer directly experiencing the world outside your own skin. It's coming to you through Mark Zuckerberg or somebody else, or God forbid, Henry Kissinger. The other quote is the old cogito ergo sum. So if we're not thinking anymore, you know,
who are we?
So it kind of makes the thing about the purpose of the species a little less far-fetched. I want to try to make a leap to reopen to reinvent.
Yeah.
And your whole discussion about culture, How does all of this relate to the question of culture in education, or just culture in the culture? You know, you're saying things like, to build trust, schools must create personal connections with each and every child and family as a matter of routine. This can't be just a one-hour meeting, but it instead must be a rhythm of deep connections that occur over time. Well, how are we going to do that?
Yeah, well, so let's start with the question of how this relates to ChatGPT and then answer that. One, when I define culture, right, I'm using the Edgar Schein definition, the MIT professor, and he said culture, right, is the shared, in effect, processes and priorities of an organization. Yeah. And so when you think about that, I think it becomes very tied to how we absorb ChatGPT or other similar technologies, which is, what are the shared processes we have around the use of it, how we embed it, and the priorities we have for it? Where do we assign it value, and where do we say it's not a value, right? And where do we find it to be useful and not be useful, and have a shared understanding and build a shared understanding intentionally of that? I think that's going to be really critical. On the second one, I think it goes back to the same design, right? If you redesign this learning environment, these classrooms, whatever you want to call them, these spaces of learning, and now the teacher is not sage on the stage delivering, but, you know, I can be learning through my projects that I'm doing through digital content, et cetera, et cetera. There can be offline manipulatives, whatever, right? And the teacher's job is to really observe and walk around and, oh yeah, Gary gets it, or I'm ready. Let's help him move on to the next thing, though, because he's not, he just seems like he's dwelling. I'm going to spend time one-on-one with you. Oh, okay. We're going to group a few of us together so that we can dig in on this question. I, as a teacher, actually don't even know about this topic, but I can see these three students are hammering at it. So let me help, you know, how I sort of showcase how I would look into it, right? All of a sudden, we've created a much more personal set of conversations that have occurred in the classrooms and connections between educator and students. And frankly, then it's not that much harder to imagine how that extends to the families themselves as part of that.
Well, I would question that. Maybe not in Lexington, but I don't know if you can make that leap in Boston.
Well, I think you can. I mean, look, Springboard Collaborative is a nonprofit that works with school districts, recognizing, again, 13% of the waking hours are in school, the rest is out of school. And they help districts with a clear 6-part template for how do you engage the families themselves in reading, and what's a productive use of the parents' time or guardian's time or one parent's time, like whatever it is, right, with your child in reading? And how do you even have those conversations and create time for those conversations? And the districts they work with seem to get some pretty really, you know, good results, because all of a sudden they're all swimming in the same direction, maybe for the first time.
In Boston, at the moment, and for a long time, there has been a tremendous amount of distrust between parents and the school district.
Yeah, so I think that's right, Gary. And my sense is that, you know, no wonder, right? Because we go back to culture and shared processes and priorities, and there aren't any. There's, you know, they're at odds with each other. Schools are often lying to the parents, frankly, about the progress of the kids and what they actually understand. It's all sorts of confusing systems around how you even get to school and which school you're going to get to. And I think parents rightfully feel that trust or promises are broken, right? And therefore it's frayed. And I know educators feel, you know, parents aren't probably doing what they should be doing either on the other end of it, but pretty confident it's going to have to be one of two things will happen. Either we'll see what's happening in Detroit and other places where parents are starting to create micro schools outside of the district, right? And opting out completely of the district, to build an education system for their kids, or the educators are going to have to flip this around to be much more intentional and deliberate about creating a culture in which they're swimming with the parents, not against them. And I agree with you, that is not easy, but I think it can be done theoretically in the environments. Now, given the legacy of the structures, I don't know if Boston can turn it around, but I guess I'm saying in an urban environment with lots of low-income students, lots of families that feel disenfranchised, can it be done? I think at a small scale, there's evidence that we can. Can you do it across a system that's operated like this? I don't know the answer to that. There's not a lot of evidence to make you feel optimistic there.
Geez, I don't want to end on that note.
Well, let me say it on the positive side again, which is I do think we're seeing really small micro school communities pop up in these urban environments that are doing some remarkable things. And it's led by one educator that, you know, that creates an incredible set of connections.
Yeah.
And to me, it says schools could do this work, right? We push resources down to the classroom, to the schools themselves, as opposed to sucking it up into the central office. Mm-hmm. And I think there is the opportunity to do a lot of this.
Well, there's another option, which is community collaborations.
Yes.
There's a couple of those. Are you familiar with Higher Ground at all?
Yeah, I know them. Yeah.
You know, it's Hubie Jones started it about 10 years ago. Community collaboration of 15 or 20 nonprofits and a bunch of schools, somewhat place-based, or at Roxbury and North Dorchester. And that's what we're part of that. That's what the idea is, to build a whole community coalition.
Well, and that's what you really want, is that bottom-up, community-driven process. Yeah. I mean, look at Salem, right? That's another good, I think, example.
Salem?
Yeah, in Massachusetts, right? Where really the city and the community said, we're not just going to rely on the schools, we're going to come around them. And obviously the new lieutenant governors from there. And so I think that there's, again, there are these glimmers that suggest we can do this.
Well, we damn well better, because, the society obviously is, fragmenting. And the only institution that has the remotest potential of pulling things together is public education. It's the only place, every single kid in the country has to be there for 18 years, for a long time. That's the only institution that any positive change might come out of. So we had better continue talking, because
keep up the good work.
Well, we'll check back in another few months and see if we have redefined the purpose of the species yet.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
We would like to thank Michael B. Horn for joining us this month for the JFY Networks podcast. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which also features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources, including this monthly podcast, to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.